This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. No poet ever saw the mysteries of the world more clearly than Elizabeth Bishop, writes Lloyd Schwartz, who describes Bishop as among the 20th century's greatest poets. Lloyd has co-edited a new book called Bishop, Poems, Prose, and Letters, which has been published by the Library of America. Lloyd has written about Bishop for The New Yorker and edited a 1983 collection of essays about her. You probably also know Lloyd as our classical music critic. Elizabeth Bishop won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award and served in the position now known as Poet Laureate. She died in 1979 at the age of 68. Here's Lloyd Schwartz reading Bishop's best-known poem, One Art.
One Art. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster, places and names and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch. And look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I miss them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster.
Lloyd is going to read more poems from the new Elizabeth Bishop collection, but first we're going to talk about her life and work. You not only were a fan of Elizabeth Bishop's writing, you were a friend of hers. How did you get to know her?
She came to teach at Harvard. She was replacing Robert Lowell in 1970, and I was still a graduate student, although I was teaching and living in Cambridge. She gave a reading, and I had admired her work for years. She had already met Frank Bidart, who was a friend of mine and a classmate, and Frank introduced us after the reading, and I can reproduce our entire first conversation. I said to her, "Oh, Miss Bishop, that was a wonderful reading. I've admired your work for years." And she replied, "Thank you." And that was our entire first conversation. And it really took several years of, you know, running into her at, you know, at gatherings or cocktail parties or at readings. And one day I sort of screwed up my courage and invited her to lunch, and she accepted. And I think that was, in some ways, that was the start of something that really became a friendship.
Well, you include in the new Bishop collection a poem that she never intended to publish. It's called Breakfast Song, and it probably never would have been published had you not found the poem when she was still alive. There's a great story behind this poem that I'm going to ask you to tell.
Okay. We were just really beginning to get to know each other a little better. And that day that I took her to lunch, I had mentioned that I was going to be stuck in Cambridge over the Christmas vacation. And she said, well, she would be too, and maybe we could get together. And then I didn't hear anything, and Christmas passed, and New Year's passed, and shortly after New Year's, this was in 1974, my phone rang, and it was Elizabeth Bishop. And she called and was very apologetic. She was in the hospital. She had fallen and broken her shoulder. And she was in the hospital, and she knew that I was around, and she didn't know anyone else who was in town. And she asked me to come to the hospital, which was not very far from where I lived, and get her keys and go to her apartment and bring her back some items from her apartment, her purse, her mail, and a notebook that was on her desk. So I was thrilled to be able to do that. I was happy to do something for her. And I did, and I came, brought everything to the hospital. And then she had to be taken out of the room, I think probably for an x-ray, but I don't really remember exactly what it was for. And I'm sitting in her hospital room with her notebook. And I open the notebook, and there is this poem on the page, which I read. And I thought it was extraordinary. I thought it was just one of the best things by her that I had ever read. And I also, because it was very personal, there was something, some nagging sense that I had that I might never see this poem again. And I tore out a page, a blank page from the notebook, and I copied it. I copied the poem just so that I could live with it, so that I could read it. And I didn't tell her that I did that. And I'd hoped that, you know, in a year or so, or maybe she would publish it and that I would see it in print. And I didn't. And after she died, I know that scholars went through all of her papers, which were at Vassar College, where she was an undergraduate. And that poem never surfaced, and the notebook never surfaced. I don't know what happened to it. And 20 years after she died, I finally sent a copy to her estate and to her publisher, because I wanted people to know this poem.
And you've included it in the book.
Oh, yes.
And it's a beautiful poem, so I'm going to ask you to read it for us, and then we'll talk about it a little bit more.
I would love to. Thank you. Breakfast Song. My love, my saving grace, your eyes are awfully blue. I kiss your funny face, your coffee-flavored mouth. Last night I slept with you. Today I love you so. How can I bear to go as soon I must, I know, to bed with ugly death in that cold, filthy place, to sleep there without you, without the easy breath and night-long, limb-long warmth I've grown accustomed to. Nobody wants to die. Tell me it is a lie. But no, I know it's true. It's just the common case. There's nothing one can do. My love, my saving grace, your eyes are awfully blue. Early and instant blue.
I love that poem, and I love her description of death as a cold, filthy place.
Yeah.
Just again, this is a poem which you never intended to publish, and it would never, no one in the world would have known about it had you not copied it when she was in the hospital.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm grateful that you did. I'm sure everyone who reads her is grateful that you did, and yet, when you were doing it, did you feel at all like it was an act of betrayal?
Well, she didn't show me the poem. And so in some way, I was doing something behind her back. And I'm not exactly proud of that. On the other hand, I wasn't doing it for gain or you know, anything like that. I was doing it. I copied it because I loved the poem and I wanted to be able to read it and reread it.
The poem that you just read, which is part love poem, part fear of death poem, was, I assume, written for a woman because Elizabeth Bishop was a lesbian.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you think that's part of the reason why she was so uncomfortable publishing personal poems, because it's a truth about her life that she probably felt very uncomfortable speaking openly about.
I rather like to think about, I think I do think about it from a different direction, that she was someone who was, even from her earliest childhood, someone who was very private, who at least in theory didn't believe in making very personal things public. And I think it was more a kind of family trait than, you know, or cultural trait of, you know, a New Englander. Of course, I'm sure that the fact that she was also a lesbian heightened that sense of keeping things private, because it could be dangerous to let the public know about sexual orientation at that time. But I think this, I think it starts earlier than that.
You know, the breakfast poem that you just read, you know, we're talking about how she didn't like to be too personal in her poems. It's a poem that's at once very intimate without really being personal.
Mm-hmm.
It's about really intimate thoughts, but you have no idea to whom this poem is addressed,
right,
what their relationship is like. So you can't really read too much into the details of her life. She gives up nothing in terms,
right,
of that.
Except that she slept with someone.
That she slept with someone. We don't know, yeah, if it's a man or a woman, a young person or,
right,
an old person.
Right.
Now, there's another poem that I know you like very much called In the Waiting Room.
Mm.
And this is a poem that's really a memory of being not quite 7 years old in the dentist's waiting room while her aunt was actually in with the dentist. And while Elizabeth Bishop, the young Elizabeth Bishop, is in the dentist's waiting room, she's reading an edition of National Geographic dated February 1918. And as I was reading the poem, I thought, wow, that was a really old edition of the magazine. Who keeps magazines around for so many decades?
Mm-hmm.
What was such an old edition doing in the office? And then I realized, wait a minute, she was born in 1911, so this was the current edition. And it made me think about what a different era she was from. World War One was still underway at the time this memory takes,
yeah,
place. And so she was born into a different world, a different sensibility, like before radio and television and cars and, mm-hmm, you know, movies. And so I guess I wondered if you felt that reflected in your relationship with her or in her poems, that she emerged from another world.
Well, I think that's a very good question. And one of the things that I love about that poem In the Waiting Room is I think it's a kind of primary example of the way she deals with the dilemmas and contradictions of being a human being. And she's, you know, just about to be 7 years old and is having an identity crisis. But she's writing about it as she is about to turn 60 and still having an identity crisis. And what does it mean to be a human being? And what does it mean to have an identity? And how much one has to have an identity, and how terrifying it is to have an identity, to be stuck in an identity.
Why don't you read an excerpt of the poem? The poem's a little long for us to have you read the whole thing, but read your favorite passage from the poem. And before you read it, explain what was in the National Geographic that she was looking at in the waiting room.
Yeah, well, she's, of course, one of the things that the National Geographic was good for was to give you very exotic and even kind of sexual imagery. She's looking at pictures of African tribal women naked with their necks with these kind of neck braces wrapped around their heads, and they were frightening and fascinating, and that's what she's looking at in the waiting room.
Okay, read the passage for us.
I said to myself, 3 days and you'll be 7 years old. I was saying it to stop the sensation of falling off the round, turning world into cold, blue-black space. But I felt, you are an I. You are an Elizabeth. You are one of them. Why should you be one too? I scarcely dared to look to see what it was I was. I gave a sidelong glance. I couldn't look any higher. At shadowy gray knees, trousers and skirts and boots, and different pairs of hands lying under the lamps. I knew that nothing stranger had ever happened. That nothing stranger could ever happen. Why should I be my aunt, or me, or anyone? What similarities? Boots, hands, the family voice I felt in my throat, or even the National Geographic and those awful hanging breasts, held us all together, or made us all just one. How, I didn't know any word for it, how unlikely.
You know, it's like this memory of being seven years old and having this epiphany about the interconnectedness yet isolation of every human being. That's a pretty pretty profound thought for a seven-year-old to be having. I know she's reliving this as a 60-year-old woman, but still, I can't imagine quite experiencing thought on that level at the age of seven.
Yeah, there's an interesting letter to Frank Bidart about this poem in which she says other people have talked to her, have told her about these kind of childhood epiphanies. Reading her poem in the New Yorker, that people remembered similar things that happened to them when they were children.
Octavio Paz once wrote an article about Elizabeth Bishop that was headlined "The Power of Reticence." Mm-hmm. And since, you know, you've talked about how private she was as a person and as a writer, what kind of example did she set for you as a poet about the power of reticence? Because, you know, really, there's a period, I think particularly in the 60s, when poets became almost like guru-like figures, they were very public. Particularly if you look at, say, like Allen Ginsberg as an example, who'd appear in like student unions around the country naked, and, you know, and had this incredible cult following. And he was so personal in his writing. And there were many other, you know, writers, you know, who were similar in having a very public and very large personality.
Yeah, it was around that time that Elizabeth said she believed in closets, closets, and more closets. I think the lesson for writers, why I love to teach Elizabeth Bishop and assign her poems to my writing students, is how economical her poems are. That she once said in an essay that she never finished writing, describing the poems that she liked best, that the qualities she most admired were accuracy, spontaneity, and mystery, which are three very interesting qualities, which I think really, she's really describing her own work. this wonderful eye for detail, this sense of living through the poem spontaneously. That is, you know how carefully written it is, but when you read the poem, you feel you're living through the experience as she is living through it, just as she's kind of reliving her childhood in the waiting room. But always with a sense of mystery, that there's something left to the imagination, that there's something between the lines. And maybe they are the qualities that exist in every great poem. So that's what one would like to aspire to as a writer.
Well, Lloyd, congratulations on editing the book, and thank you so much for sharing some of her poems with us.
Thank you for having me.
Lloyd Schwartz co-edited the new book, Bishop, Poems, Prose, and Letters. He's also our classical music critic. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.